All right. Recorder is now on. So I wanted first to see if you had questions that we discussed Tuesday. Then what I was hoping would be interesting if you had questions from the reading you have done, which should be different for each person, and then go on to talk about more stuff, assuming we have time. Yeah.
Last time we were talking about theory about why the interstates arose.
Yes.
I mean, you said autonomous there, seem to have pressure, but I was wondering, maybe in general, I was wondering, so the major states are kind of a form of technology with that speech control system that has happened in some countries, and it is often a problem of
The general question, the question which is suggested by this, but which I don't have a good answer, is why you have the rise of the nation state. So the point I make, I think, at some point in the chapter, is that in a way what the Ottomans are doing in the 19th century when they're annexing the walks, the foundations, is like Henry VIII back in the 16th century seizing the monasteries. So that I think it's pretty clear that you've got in Western Europe a shift towards something more like a nation state, happening somewhere around the 16th century, that the Tudors, that after the Tudors, you don't really have a situation where, in effect, the barons have their own armies and the king depends on an alliance of barons to support him, which I think is what's really happening in the Wars of the Roses, even, which are ended by Henry VII, the first Tudor. So you know, I'm not an expert on it, but I would have said that there is, for some reason, a general trend towards something more like what we would think of as a nation, initially with absolute monarchy and later with modern institutions. There must be some cause for it, but I don't know what that cause is, but it's plausible that that cause existed in the Islamic world as well as in the Christian world. I don't know enough about the other major states other than the Ottomans, the only one they've really looked at. You've got the Safavids, the Persian, who were sort of competitors, in some ways enemies of the Ottomans. You've got the Mughals ruling India further east, and I don't know enough about them to know to what extent the same thing happened, but at least it seems to me that the way I would read the evidence is that the same general things were happening in the Ottomans and Western Europe somewhere around the 16th, 17th century, and that's what ultimately, if Locke is right about the original system, that's what ultimately destroys it. That would be my guess, but it's only a guess. It's, you know, this is something people could spend a lifetime on trying to make sense of, and I haven't. So did people, from your readings, I gave all of you that interesting essay in sort of giving a detailed account of the disputes over authenticity of the Hadith, which I thought was quite fun, and then you were each supposed to have read your own 20 pages of one of the primary sources that I had a link to on the syllabus, and I was wondering if you would come across things in that that puzzled you or interested you or you wanted to tell other people about. No. Huh. For when we do Chinese law, what I generally do is to divide up the primary source so that essentially all of it has gotten read by someone. And I think our primary sources here are a little bit long to do that with. But I'm not sure if it would be worth, if I do this again, to actually assigning, you know, you get this 20 pages, you get the next 20 or not. Would that be a better system or not? Any opinions? Anyway, so nobody from anything you've read has any questions or anything of interest or anything you might tell the rest of us about. Yes?
I stumbled upon the section that I shared in the talk. I think about pollution. Or if I could
This is in which? In The Traveler or in the other one? There are two different, I had two different primary sources, so I think
so. Impression of it, but it's kind of like you have to do this ritual.
What I think is going on is that in particular before you pray, you must be ritually clean. And that there is then a sort of a lesser pollution and a greater pollution. And they're associated with some of the things you would expect, such as excretion and sex and stuff of that sort. Although I believe that petting a dog is also polluting. And I'm not sure if it's looting for this purpose or not, whether the dog is thought of as an unclean animal. Muhammad seems to prefer cats to dogs on various evidence. And then, if you've got the lesser pollution, you remember that Muslims are supposed to pray a fixed number of times a day at particular times. That's one of the sort of religious obligations. You've got to be clean to pray. So therefore, before praying, you have to wash yourself, ritual washing, particularly described in some detail. And if you've had the more serious pollution, you're supposed to essentially bathe. There's a kind of a bath which is used for cleansing you. So that's probably what you were reading about. There's a passage I always find quite amusing in The Thousand Nights and a Night. I don't know if any of you ever read The Thousand Nights and a Night, but sometimes called The Arabian Nights. But it's this story where you've got the frame story and then a whole bunch of stuff within it. And the frame story involves two brothers, one of whom is a major king and one of whom is sort of a more minor king under him, both of whom discover their wives to have been unfaithful with them, to them. And then the story sort of goes on from there. And there's a little bit of a scene when the second one, in fact, when the first brother sees the second one's wife engaged in an orgy, essentially, along with a bunch of her handmaids and a bunch of Mamelukes, white male, white slaves. And at the end of the orgy, they all go into the fountain to do the goo's ablution, as would be proper. That is to say, they've got to cleanse themselves after sex, and the mere fact that the sex is adulterous doesn't seem to bother them, but of course they wouldn't want to pray without being properly cleansed, and I thought that was sort of a fun, an amusing touch of what was going on. So that's the goo's ablution is what that one is called, as I recall, and that's what you're supposed to do after sex, and I don't remember after what else. But then there are all sorts of discussions in the law about what if there isn't any water available at the time for prayer. What if the water is in some sense impure or polluted? Has a dog drunk from the water? That was the question. A cat drinking was part of the other thing that you all read from the syllabus, tradition of whether or not a cat drinking from water made it impure for washing yourself, for ritually washing yourself with. So all of that stuff. And one of the things that's striking when you read these legal texts is how much of the space is given over to what we would think of as purely religious issues. This long discussion of how you're supposed to do your prayer and the sequence of the prayer and the words you're supposed to say. And there's generally a distinction between what they think you're obligated to do and what there is some reason to think Muhammad did, and therefore it's probably a good thing to do, but you don't have to, sort of a model for the best way of doing your prayers. If you look at Maimonides, I was only pointing you at three volumes of the Mishneh Torah. The thing is like 14 volumes or 15 volumes long. Why? Because a whole lot of the rest of it is detailed religious law, which struck me. I mean, it's interesting if you wanted to study the system, but it seemed to be more interesting to us is to look at the parts that overlap with our legal system and see how they handle the same questions. So that's true in all of those. And what the explanation is, I don't know if I have any deep explanation of why so much attention is given to these things, but it is. But again, if you look at the stuff you read about the gypsies also have elaborate rules of pollution, and some similarity in the rules of pollution. Again, they tend to be down on sex and excretion and of cleansing yourself. Yeah.
So would that lead you to think that a lot of stuff that has to do with what we were talking about earlier about
separating yourself?
Oh. Well, just safety and
health. Well, that's one theory would be that the ultimate function is to prevent transmission of diseases. Now, how do they know? Maybe they just casually observed, or maybe they created it for religious reasons and it worked, and therefore they prospered. That's one theory, and the other theory that we've discussed is that it's a way of separating yourself from the non-members by imposing requirements. And yet a third theory that we discussed a little bit is it's a way of proving you really believe in the religion. Yeah.
Yeah, the disease theory is kind of interesting, because I think there's something like a long time ago before the whole reality show, when they talked about, I think it might have been a Jewish sect, not the whole community, but the way they clean themselves was like a full immersion cleaning after, excretion, basically, dumping yourself in the pool, you got like hepatitis from this, and I think it was kind of ironic.
Yeah, might be, as you can certainly imagine. Yeah.
Then I was along the same lines, I was going to comment that perhaps it has some kind of spiritual significance as well. I mean, along the lines of following the religion, but also maybe the act of cleansing yourself is kind of becoming pure before God.
Yeah, there are two senses in which you might say that. One of them is they believe it does this and therefore they do it, which is fine. But if you ask, is it functional, it might also be that what you're calling spiritual, someone else might call psychological, that it makes you feel somehow pure, and that makes you more productive, more honest, more whatever, I don't know. But you could certainly imagine, without understanding it very well, that some of these things you might see as sort of a technology for manipulating your psyche, if that makes any sense.
Well, yeah, one of the adages from Western culture is cleanliness is close to godliness.
Yeah. Yeah. But what the basis of that is, I don't know. But that is, you could certainly, again, if you look at the extraordinary initial success of Islam, one way of making sense of that is to take a version of Ibn Khaldun's story and say, look, these people all believed in this. Well, it's a whole lot easier to win a war when your people don't mind dying if they have to. All right, if you sort of think about my standard story, which I think I was telling in my other class for explaining what economists call market failure, is to imagine you're one of a line of soldiers with spears, 5,000 of you, and they're all pointing that way, because in that direction there are 5,000 men on horses with spears coming at you. And you do a quick cost-benefit calculation, and you say, if we all stand and hold our spears, with luck we will break their charge, and some of us will die, and most of us will live. If we all run, horses can run faster than we can. And you say, no, I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. If everybody else runs, my only chance is to run first. If everybody else stands and I run, there are 5,000 people in the line, losing one person won't have much effect, and I won't be one of the ones killed. Everyone does that calculation, they all run, and they all die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. If that's the case, for those of you who are familiar with the prisoner's dilemma, this is just a many-player equivalent of the prisoner's dilemma, it's a situation where individual rationality doesn't lead to group rationality. One solution to that is if you can change people's values. So if I have an army where everybody in the army thinks that winning this battle is more important than the detail of whether I live or die, I'm going to have a real advantage over the other side, because I will put them in a situation like this and they'll run away, and they'll put me in a situation like this and I won't run away. All right? The story, did I tell this class the story of the sacred band? Well, I mentioned that in the other one, but it's related to the same issue. The sacred band of Thebes was a military unit in ancient Greece, which was made up of pairs of homosexual lovers, no one of which would show cowardice in the presence of his beloved or betray his beloved. And they won every battle they fought until the last, when they encountered an army commanded by Philip of Macedon and his son Alexander, later Alexander the Great, and died to a man. But you can see that in modern warfare, in the degree to which you encourage the idea that these are your buddies. We aren't really fighting for the country, I'm fighting for him and him and him, and if I run away, I'm double-crossing them, that kind of feeling. So I think you get elements of that in lots of... And so that may really be, I'm going back to Ibn Khaldun, it may really be that the fundamental explanation of how the Muslims conquered half of their world, so to speak, not the whole world, you know, but the new world, was because they had enough people who really believed in it. And they were... So, anyway, the... I don't know.
And then another follow-up, too. Do you have any thoughts on how animals became to be classified as clean or impure? I mean, I know there was mention of the carrion eaters, and I mean, I could definitely see how that would lead to an animal being classified as impure.
Yes. But I don't know in general. That is, there is a tradition that Muhammad said that on some occasion he was supposed to meet with the angel Gabriel, and Gabriel didn't show up. And the next time he's speaking, Gabriel is the one who reveals the Quran to him. The next time he sees Gabriel, he's saying, why didn't you come? Gabriel says, oh, there was a dog in the house. Didn't you know angels don't go in a house that dogs are in? And that's a tradition. How reliable it is, I don't know. But the reason for it, I don't know. Dogs are carrion eaters, but dogs are also very useful. Cats are also useful. They keep down mice in the grain stores and such. So I don't really know on what basis they did it, but it's pretty clear that as the religious law develops, there are definite rules about different kinds of animals and which kinds of animals you can or can't touch the water and without making it impure, or which you can touch without making you impure, and so forth. You know, all sorts of complicated rules of that sort. Yes?
So in at least one day, it seems from having experience that dogs aren't really, it's kind of weird to have a dog as a pet in generally the Middle East. At least in two species that I've heard of and one that I visited, Is that, do you think that stems from
I don't know.
The past or the other way around?
I don't know. Dogs are used as hunting animals, certainly in Persia, and I would have guessed in the Middle East, though I don't know as well. Did you observe cats being used as pets?
I didn't even notice, really. It was actually just pointed out to me that the whole owning a dog was kind of an oddity. Whereas here, owning a dog is fairly common. And I was wondering if that stemmed from maybe the religious belief or that social belief has influenced.
I do not know. No, an interesting question in general. We're a very rich society. I'm not sure how many of you realize just how rich we are. The book I was reading, which has some of the figures, and roughly speaking, I think the average per capita real income of the world is about 10 times what it was through most of history. And in developed countries, it's like 20 times or 30 times what it was. That real, meaning attempting to adjust for price change, which is always hard to do. So in that sense, it may well be that most previous society, most people couldn't afford pets. Because couldn't afford is too strong. But if you say, look, we're in it, most of the population is at the point where they're starting to go hungry if you don't have food, we aren't going to feed your food to the pets. So you will have cats which are supporting themselves, and if maybe you help a little bit because they eat the mice that are eating your grain, and you have dogs which are acting as guard dogs and such. But our idea of having pets just for pets. Now the other thing, of course, is that I think one of the functions of pets in our society is a substitute for children. That I think of sort of, there's a very interesting book called The Selfish Gene about evolutionary biology, which I would recommend. And there's a bit in it where he explains about the revolting robots. He says that you get this theme sometimes in science fiction where humans make robots and the robots revolt and they go, well, he says it's happened and we're the robots. That is to say, our genes designed us, as if designed us via Darwinian evolution, and what were they designing us for? Reproductive success. Not the good of the species. From the standpoint of the genes in your body, what it cares about is how many copies of it go into future generations. That determines whether it's around in the future. So we're designed for reproductive success. And therefore, you would think that every human being would be trying to produce as many children as he could produce and successfully raise to adulthood. Doesn't look like the world we're living in, does it? All right. Nobody I know is doing that. Why? Because, he says, we're revolving robots. The genes created this wonderful technology called rationality, thinking, which resulted in humans being an immensely successful species, and the individual human who was rational was very successful relative to the individual human who was stupid, so therefore it spread. But there's one problem with rationality. Rationality lets the human spot the conflict of interest between himself and his genes, and sacrifice the objective of the genes to his own objective. Hence, contraception, pre-modern contraceptive things, that is, non-reproductive sex of various sorts, and how do the genes try to control us? They give us pleasure in sex. Well, that's all right. We have non-reproductive sex. They make us like to have small children. Well, pets will do as well, and they don't have the same problem, and so forth. So it's quite a neat passage. I think he's got a real point there about, there's a really striking point, is that if you take Darwinian evolution seriously, it's puzzling why I don't have eight kids. And yet, I don't think I know a single person who has eight kids. Yeah.
I've heard a lot about that, not about that particular argument, but along those lines here. Like the chemical reaction that a mother has when she first has a child, that she goes through during childbirth that creates that bond, is a response, evolutionary response, because the mother, it's in the best interest of the species for the mother to love the child and to protect the child. So it's interesting.
But it's not the species. It isn't the species. You are not designed to help the human species. You're designed to for your reproductive success, even if it torpedoes the species. Because that is to say, it's the same problem as my, it's exactly the same problem as my line of spearmen. It's in the interest of the whole line for them to stand. But if the individual acts in his rational moment, he runs. It might be in the interest of the human species, especially nowadays, to keep population down. That's our rule. But if you keep population down and I don't, after all, everybody's descended from me, not you, and therefore everybody has the genes that make you have lots of kids. So that's why it's a puzzle. If Darwinian evolution is right, and I think it's the best theory we've got to explain why living creatures are what they're like, why human beings do not have many more children than they do, and say this is at least Dawkins' explanation for it.
Well, and those are the rules, if you look at who are reproducing as well, who are more likely to reproduce and what demographic they come from.
That's been a long argument, that is, and the trouble with the argument is that the empirical prediction isn't just yet. The argument's been made for 100 years or so, basically that the rich and educated don't have kids and the poor and uneducated do, therefore human beings get stupider and stupider. The problem is that the data we have show exactly the opposite effect. There's something called the Flynn effect, which is a real interesting puzzle, which I don't have a good answer. But it turns out, as Flynn is I think an Australian psychologist, I guess, and he looked at various tests that are essentially IQ tests or proxies for IQ tests, going back as far as he had data. And it looks as though human IQs for the last 100 years in many different countries have been drifting up. And what makes it puzzling is if you take his results seriously, it's hard to understand the world of 100 years ago. Because it looks as though the normal then was what we regard as very stupid. And yet, you know, they were writing books, they were making inventions, and all sorts of things. And there are a variety. I don't think anybody has a really adequate explanation either of why the Flynn effect happened or how you can explain the fact that if you look at past history, people don't look as stupid as that extrapolation suggests they should have. But if you're not aware of it, it's sort of a very interesting puzzle in the modern world. And I think Flynn's view, I think, is that what the tests are measuring is some particular subset of intelligence, and the features of the modern world have resulted in our getting better at that, but not as intelligent in general. But whether he's right, I don't know.
I was going to say maybe better access to education.
Well, except that my impression at least, and it's not something I studied very carefully, is that the obvious explanations, the people look at this, is that different countries have happened, what's happening in countries where things weren't getting better, or we're getting better, some measures of intelligence are taken very young, so it's hard to know. Now, I have a theory of my own, but I think it's wrong, but it's a theory coming out of evolutionary biology, and then my theory goes as follows. Human beings have got this real design problem. And the design problem is getting the head of the infant through the pelvis of the mother. Because humans have big heads. Humans, if you make, women have wider pelvises than men. The result is that on average they can't run as well. If you make the pelvis still wider, they run still worse. And after a while they start getting eaten by predators. So there's a limit to how much you can expand that variable. At the same time, human babies are born premature by the standards of most other species. Compare what a puppy or a kitten is doing at a week with what a baby is doing at a week. Well, if you push it more premature, that causes problems. But doing that means the baby is smaller when it comes out. So my conclusion from all of this is that prior to modern times, head size has got to have a value or we wouldn't have it. All right, the big head is expensive because it increases deaths in childbirth, if I have anything else. So the conjecture is larger heads have some tendency to give a payoff in higher intelligence. Obviously, it's not a hyperbolic correlation, but some correlation. So each generation, the babies with the big head, each generation, infants with large heads and mothers whose genes tend to produce infants with large heads are being selectively killed off, because they're having a higher death rate in childbirth than everybody else. Those babies with big heads who make it through, however, are then more successful because big head is associated with conjecture of the higher intelligence. So in every generation, the genetic head size is larger than the observed head size, because in every generation, the genes would make, say, 10% of the babies have large heads. But because more of the large-headed babies die in being born than the small-headed babies, the actual people out there are 8%. But then those 8% do better, and therefore you're back at 10% for the next generation. Make sense? Doesn't make sense. Probably not important enough to go through.
But if it's a problem with that, where do you see as the deficiency?
It isn't a deficiency at all. The argument is that then when we finally get modern obstetrics, practically nobody dies in childbirth in modern obstetrics. So once you have modern obstetrics, now the head size in the living people goes up to the genetic head size. The number of big-headed babies who survive childbirth is the same as the number who start. So therefore, intelligence goes up. So that was, it's an attempt to explain the Flynn effect.
As opposed to the big-headed babies.
That's right. The big-headed babies are no longer selectively learning. And if it's the case that big-headed babies are more reproductively successful now, which they might or might not be, because there's the argument the other way, that if you're successful, you don't have many kids. But supposing it were the case, you'd then have a tendency for intelligence to steadily rise. So anyway, it was my very clever but probably wrong explanation for Flynn effect. You can find it on their webpage if you're curious.
And
you got that one, yes. That's my other one was an idea for a science fiction story, which is an intelligent race of marsupials. You know what marsupials are, like kangaroos? Marsupials have solved the problem because the marsupials have their infants born premature and then put them in the pouch, which is outside the pelvis, for the final stage of maturation. So the idea is some alien marsupials who know as a scientific fact that the only mammals that can become intelligent are marsupials. Because any non-marsupial mammal runs into this bind that I've just described. And then they come and they're observing Earth from orbit and they can't figure out where the intelligent species is. But we can't possibly be it because we're not marsupials, even though we seem to be. So we must somehow be the pets or the tame animals of some marsupials, but they can't figure out where they are. That was the idea, anyway. But I've never written that. I'm never going to write it. Yes?
I have a question. Have you come across anything suggesting that the gene's objective to reproduce itself could have any basis for causing racism? That people like have seen.
That's interesting.
Let me put
it differently. One way your genes can reproduce themselves is by your having kids.
Mm-hmm.
Another way is by your brother or sister having kids. Your brother and sister have half your genes, roughly, the 50% correlation. So that, therefore, this has to do with the puzzle of altruism. Why are human beings, to some extent, altruistic? And one answer is, because if I can save the life of my sister at only a small risk to my own life, that increases my reproductive success. It doesn't decrease it, because if I'm producing more than two of her children for every one of my children lost, that's a net gain. So then you could argue that there will be some tendency to say, well, who looks like me? People who look like me are likely to have some of my genes. Consequently, if I have a habit of being nice to people who look like me, that will to some extent increase the spread of my genes. So that's a possible explanation. I don't know if it's right or not, but it's an interesting thought. Yeah?
Another one is fear of the unknown.
Yeah, no, that's in a sense rational. You know, the more different they are, the less I can predict what they're going to do, and they might take a climb and hit me.
Might be.
While we're talking about all this irrelevant stuff, because it's interesting, one of the other patterns you see in human behavior is the tendency to see patterns that aren't there. All right? If you think of conspiracy theories and things like that. And I think that's explainable, too, that what's going on is that we have been provided by evolution with really good pattern recognition software. It's so good it can see patterns that aren't there. And why is that right? Because there's always a trade-off. All right, if I only say, yes, it's a pattern if I'm sure, well, I will rarely see patterns that aren't there, but I'll sometimes miss patterns that are there. So if you think about it, what statisticians call errors of the first sort and errors of the second sort, the error of thinking something is there that isn't or isn't there that is. Well, failing to recognize a tiger hidden in a bush is a really lethal mistake. Thinking there's a tiger hidden in the bush when it's really just a berry tree, well, it's not a very serious problem. So it makes some sense that we would have been designed with pattern recognition that's sort of oversensitive, that sees almost all the patterns that are there and some of the ones that aren't there. And I think if you look at how human beings actually behave, you know, whether it's seeing a whale in the clouds or seeing a conspiracy when it isn't there, that it fits that idea, that that is a characteristic of humans. So I suggest. All right, let's get back to Islamic law after hopefully interesting digressions. So any more questions on either? Yes.
To talk about Katzenbach,
yes.
He talked about historical revisionism.
Yes.
And I was curious if...
And anti-revisionism.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I was curious if you've seen a pattern between, or a correlation between legal systems that are based on religious texts versus legal systems that are just have a secular basis. Like if the, what role the religion is.
Huh. Well, that's my impression is that in American law, you get a certain amount of it. You get, if you think about arguments over the Second Amendment, say, you get people who say this is what it meant. No, they were wrong. Here's the evidence and so forth. So now, of course, this is a much newer system, so you wouldn't have as much of that as they do. But also a lot of what's going on is sort of the encounter of traditional Islam with modern scholarship. And the modern scholars have less of a commitment to the traditional view, whether right or wrong. But as you may know, this is all paralleled by biblical scholarship, which I know much less about, but my impression is that a bunch of the sort of stuff that's being described in that, the textual analysis, that there are various arguments about who wrote which part of the New Testament, and when was the New Testament written, and stuff of that sort, and it's again the same kind of exercise, and for that matter, it's about the whole Shakespeare controversy. Because, you know, various people who argue Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare, and what's the evidence for that? And the story, which is probably not true, is of some academic who has a software program for identifying authors, and he applies it to Shakespeare's plays, and he concludes that they were written by three different people. And so somebody else puts his article through his own software and concludes it was written by three different people. Which we presume it was not, at least I assume not. But no, I don't know. Are there any things on sort of the actual content of what you're reading? No. Let me then go on. Yes.
I thought it was interesting they had a little small section on the rules about yawning and sneezing, and it's interesting that, you know, we say God bless you.
Yes.
And so it's almost to the, at least in Western culture, I've always heard that it goes back to thinking like the devil or spirit or something has escaped you, and you'll want to like forgive God for that. It seems like they're doing the same thing.
So what are they doing? I don't remember.
They just say, you know, may Allah forgive you or have mercy on you. And it's kind of the same God. And so it's like, I don't know if it's them being superstitious, or obviously they know about health and patience. So they know that they get a little dust and their nose will be sweeping. It's not like...
Well, but of course, all three, that is Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, are closely linked, right? I mean, Jesus is a Muslim prophet. Jesus is also a Jew. In that sense, it's a single tradition with three different branches, at least three different branches, arguably more than three. But... Alright, we're going to go on to talk some more about the actual content of the law, which was in one of the things you may have read, depending on which of the alternate readings you took for last class. The hot offenses are the offenses with a specified fixed punishment, which is supposed to have more or less Quranic or just after Quran, that is early practice of the early caliphs basis. So the ones I was discussing were zina, which is unlawful sexual activity, and then false accusation of unlawful sexual activity. And the third pot offense is drinking wine. And the punishment for that in three of the four schools is 80 lashes for a free man and 40 for a slave. The argument for that, apparently the Quran has three different passages on wine, but the last one says it's forbidden. But then the question is, what's the punishment? The Quran does not say that, but the argument made by one of the early caliphs was the punishment for false witness is 80 lashes. If you're drunk, you're likely to falsely accuse people of things, therefore have the same punishment for that. That seems to have been the basis of that 80 lashes, and one school didn't accept that and made it 40. There's a considerable range of opinions among the schools as to what counts as drunkenness. Everybody agrees, I think, that you're not supposed to drink wine, fermented grapes. But to what extent you're not supposed to drink other fermented things, I think the weakest version is you're not supposed to drink wine and you're not supposed to get very drunk on anything else. Whereas the strongest version would be anything which in any quantity, however large, makes you intoxicated is forbidden in any quantity, however small. That's their equivalent. I heard the name of it. There's an amendment in U.S. law which says basically you're not supposed to have anything that causes cancer, however small the amount, however large the amount of it takes to cause cancer. You're not supposed to have even very small amounts of it in food, if I've got it correct. I don't know if it's food or other things. There's some name for that, but I've forgotten it. And nobody remembers? You're all lawyers. You're supposed to know this stuff. But in any case, this is their version of that, is that if drinking a whole lot of it would get you drunk, and you can't drink any of it. And there was some dispute when coffee first comes in. Coffee comes into the Islamic world as a drink probably around 1400-ish, so it's relatively late. And there was some question as whether it counted as an intoxicant because it affected how people thought, and eventually the decision was that it wasn't, as far as I know, in all of the schools. And the requirement is two witnesses, either to the drinking, the state of drunkenness, or the smell of alcohol in your breath. And then the fourth hot offense is theft, and that, I'll discuss that a bit more if we have time, but that's the one that people all get upset about because you're cutting off the right hand. Seems like a pretty brutal punishment, but it turns out that as with the stoning the disobedient son, there are a whole lot of ways in which a judge cannot do it if he doesn't want to, basically, because there are a long list of requirements it has to meet. And then the last one is what's translated as highway robbery and really includes both highway robbery and breaking into somebody's house armed in order to rob. And that's cutting off a hand and a foot if you don't kill anybody, and crucifixion as execution if you do. Not very pleasant. And part of what's interesting about that, in a sense, from the legal standpoint, is that murder itself is really not a criminal offense in this law. As I said before, it's really treated as a tort offense. So if you merely murder somebody and his next of kin say, well, we'll forgive you, looks as though it's all over, well, almost all over, but you're supposed to do a penance as well, but at least as far as legally it's all over. But if you break into somebody's house and murder them, you get executed. His kin don't get to forgive you. So that's sort of an odd anomaly in the law. So all of those are the hot offenses. There are then the tazir offenses, which are referred to as discretionary punishment, in that those are one, it's really a list. Offenses is the wrong way of putting it, because the same offense could be both. But tazir has lower standards of proof, generally lower punishments, and the basic, what defines it really, is the judge gets to set the punishment within some range. And exactly what the range is, it depends on the view of the schools. Some schools hold that you can have fines as a punishment. Some don't. That some schools allow a female to be a witness, or two females to be a witness as a replacement of one man, I think. Some don't. And basically, the theory is a sort of, much like our theory, is sort of deterrence, reform, you know, doing things so that crime won't be a problem, but it's no longer God's orders. No longer God tells us what we have to do. It is the judgment of the judge as to what to do. And that includes a variety of different offenses, including perjury, usury, slander, but also hot offenses that don't qualify for hot punishment because they don't meet the standards, they don't have enough witnesses or things of that sort. And that's going to be a lot of the actual system. Then the one which I find interesting, because I'm interested in feud, is jinniyat. And jinniyat is the set of rules that apply to killing or injuring somebody. And that looks to me like what was a blood feud system that's been brought into the court system. So when you kill my relative, I don't just get to go out and kill you. I've got to start a court action. And the judge says, yes, indeed, he killed your father or your brother or whatever it is, and it was an inexcusable killing. Now I can kill him if I want to. Now I can retaliate. And there are basically three kinds of punishments broadly defined for jinniyat offenses. One of them is retaliation. And in the case of homicide, it basically, if it's what we would think of roughly as first-degree murder, I get to retaliate. Is it what we would think of as tortious loss of life, I don't get to retaliate. And there are various things in between that, and the details of where the lines are drawn vary with the schools of law as to how close to a deliberate murder it has to be for me to have the right of retaliation. Retaliation means I get to kill you. That is you, I think. However, the alternative to retaliation is blood money, dia. And blood money, there is a fixed formula, and it's an alternative, not an addition. So you've killed my father, I'm the elder son, I'm the closest kinsman, I think that's how it would work. And if it was a deliberate murder, I could choose to have you killed, but then I don't get anything. Or I could say I prefer the dia instead, and now you owe me don't remember. I think I give the number in the chapter. It's a bunch of camels or a fixed amount of money. There are equivalents for the camels in money. And alternatively, I could say, well, you know, I understand you were really mad at Dad, and he was a pretty irritating guy, so I forgive you. It's over. Or I could say, look, I know you can't pay the full diya. I'll take a third of it, and then I'll forgive you, which is still, from my standpoint, better than having you executed and my getting nothing. For injuries short of death, there is a formula. Same formula roughly is going to show up in Somali law later. And the formula is that if you've got two limbs and you lose one of them, you are owed half as much as if you've been killed. And it has the odd result that if you lose your nose, if you only have one nose, that counts as more than losing a leg or losing an arm, which would be only half. They do have the condition, if I've got it right, that if you have several things where the injuries add up to more than 100%, it's only 100%. So if you lose, you know, your nose and your arm, you don't get 150% of the value of your life. You only get the value of your life. And the value of life in this system is the same for everybody. All right? There's a much more complicated system we'll get to with the Irish, where everybody has his honor price, which is different for different people. But at least in the Islamic system and in the Icelandic system, Jewish system, there is no blood price because that's illegal. You're not allowed to take payment for killing. The closest kin aren't allowed to take payment for forgiving somebody. But in the Islamic one, they are. And you could argue the system is designed to avoid retaliation in the sense that if you retaliate, you give up the chance of getting any payment, which you might prefer. I should say the full diya is if you kill a free male Muslim. If you kill a non-Muslim who's legally entitled to be there, which basically means either a non-Muslim who lives under Muslim rule and pays the tax that non-Muslim is supposed to pay and is basically an accepted part of the community, or a non-Muslim who is from outside your territory but is there under safe conduct, then the amount is less, and depending on the school, it's either half or a third. And I believe it is the case that killing a woman in at least some of the schools, the payment is half as much as killing a man. I don't swear that's right, but I think that's right. So all of that are the money payments. Then the third punishment, in some sense, is penance. All right, penance exists in Christian as well, where you say you've done something wrong, now you are supposed to give up meat for 6 months or something, or do something else in order to. And in the case of the Muslim system, if you've killed somebody, I'm not sure what happens for injuries less than that, but if you killed somebody, and this includes, in general, the fact that the killing was accidental doesn't mean there's no punishment. The fact that the killing was accidental means that they don't have retaliation, but you still owe the damage payment. It's a somewhat smaller damage payment, the lesser diya instead of the larger diya, but it's not a lot smaller. Even, you don't owe it, I think, if it was self-defense kind of thing, but in the case where it was what we would think of as perhaps tortious loss of life, and there must surely be rules on deciding who's responsible when, but I don't know any of the details of that. But then, in any of these things where you've killed somebody, the usual penance is that you must either free a Muslim slave, or you must fast for 2 months, where the Muslim fast means no eating, drinking, or sex during daylight. That's what the month of Ramadan is, and the penance is to do that at some other time for a total of 2 months. In order for any of this to happen, the charge for your offense has to be brought by the nearest relative or by the victim if he's dying, say. He can charge you before he dies. So again, it looks like private law, like tort law, not like criminal law. Proof of being killed can be by two male witnesses or by confession. And there are some procedures if you don't have adequate evidence involving an oath by 50 people, which in some contexts the default rule is that 50 people swear you did it even though they aren't witnesses somehow, that you get convicted, and others, if people say you didn't do it, you get acquitted. And there's also a procedure, which I don't have in my notes, but I was reading about, where if they don't know who's responsible, 50 people in the neighborhood swear they didn't do it, and then I think they have to pay the dia, they have to pay the blood money, even though they didn't do it, but they aren't subject to any further penalty. There, as in supposedly Texas, you are allowed to kill wife, daughter, sister if caught having sex with someone they shouldn't be, or the person they're having sex with. Similarly, at least according to three schools, homicide or bodily injury is all right if you had permission of the victim, if you think about a duel or something of that sort, and self-defense is legitimate. And male non-Muslims who refuse to either pay the non-Muslim tax or convert are fair game. It's not a criminal offense to kill them. Any questions so far? Just sort of a brief summary of some of the rules. One of the ones which is still somewhat controversial, and which is again something that people point out as evidence against the system, is the rule on apostasy. Apostasy means for a Muslim to stop being a Muslim. That I think everyone in the legal system agrees that people are not required to convert to Islam. That at most, people are required to be members of one of the religions of the book, or else to leave territory ruled by Muslims. I think that's the typical rule. And so I've seen the claim that that's only true in Arabia, but I'm not sure if that's how generally that's right. People for the book, let me tell you about that, because there's a story that goes with this. And this is Ibn al-Nadim's story of the Marsh Sabaeans. Have I told you about the Marsh Sabaeans? The Quran refers to four peoples of the book. The Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, and the Sabaeans. And it's a little ambiguous, but at least there's at least one passage where it's the Sabaeans. And it wasn't entirely clear who the Sabaeans were. I think it's now believed they were a small Jewish offshoot. And that at one point early in Muhammad's history, somebody says, you know, who is he anyway? And they go, he's a Sabaean, because of what he's been preaching. So the story is that there is a pagan tribe that live in a swamp somewhere, people of no importance. And eventually they come to the notice of the caliph, and the caliph sends some of them to say, look, you're living in the lands of Islam, you must convert to one of the four peoples of the book. But you get to choose which one. It's got a year and a day, let me know. And so, being sensible people, they do some research. And they discover that there are lots of Muslims around them. They can find out what Muslims believe. They've got to pray all this time. And they can find out what Jews believe. They aren't allowed to eat pork and stuff. That's terrible. They find out what Christians believe. But there aren't any Sabaeans. And nobody knows what the Sabaeans believe. So when the messenger of the caliph comes back, they tell the messenger of the caliph that they have decided to be Sabaeans. And they continue with their religion just as it was in the days of their fathers. And when anybody comes by and asks them what religion is, oh, this is the Sabaean religion. And so al-Nadim, writing in, I think, about the 10th century, who tells this story, says that to this day, there are two kinds of Sabaeans, the real Sabaeans and the swamp Sabaeans, which I thought was, I don't know if the story is true, but it is, in fact, a roughly a 10th century story. In fact, if anybody is really interested in sort of getting a look at what, at Islamic civilization from the inside, the Theorist of al-Nadim, which in the modern translation is two fairly thick books, is something between an encyclopedia and an annotated bibliography. It's a list of every book al-Nadim has read with sort of brief summaries. So it really gives you a picture, as it were, of the intellectual world of a very widely read 10th century Muslim. But anyway, let me go on. So the question is, what's the status of apostasy? And some schools hold that the hot offense, some don't. Some schools hold that an apostate may be killed without trial. In others, the male is given 3 days to repent and can then be killed, and a female is supposed to be imprisoned and beaten until she reverses and becomes a Muslim again. And some moderns argue that it's a mistake. The basic argument is that if you look at what was going on at the time of Muhammad, Islam is not only a religion, it's also in effect a political affiliation. That is, Muhammad is fighting wars with non-Muslim, first with the non-Muslims of Mecca and then with the non-Muslim tribes around him. And that therefore the real offense wasn't not believing in the religion, it was being a traitor to the community. And that therefore some moderns argue that somebody who leaves Islam but does not ally with the enemies of Islam isn't really guilty of the relevant offense. So that's a still a live issue, I think a minority opinion. Let me go back to the theft case, because as I say, that's an interesting one in terms of the, again, the what I regard as the one of the issues when God is making the laws of what you do when you don't like them, that it's an explicit prescription in the Quran, and the prescription is that you lose your right hand for the first offense, second offense a foot, third offense another hand, third offense another foot. Now, how do you go around stealing when you don't have any hands? I don't know, but I suppose you could imagine perhaps something with your arm or something. And in order for it to go, first the victim has to bring the charge. Second, the stolen object must not have been returned before the charge is lodged. Third, the victim must be willing to be present for the amputation. But then fourth, there are a bunch of further conditions. And it looks as though it's straight explicit command, you follow it. But what are the elements? Well, for one thing, the offender must be an adult. A discerning minor is somebody of seven, and there is some punishment if a discerning minor commits a crime, but not the cat punishment. They must be mentally competent, so somebody who is lunatic or retarded doesn't. Has to be intentional. If somebody compels you to commit the theft, it doesn't count. If you are under necessity, that counts as compulsion. So a starving man who steals doesn't count as a thief. View a lot of philosophers would argue for. And furthermore, if you steal perishable food, it is assumed that it was because you were hungry and therefore it's not the hot offense of theft. It's got to be above some minimum amount, where the exact amount varies with the school. I think I worked it out that it was between 9 and 30 grams of silver, and 30 grams is about an ounce. So what is that nowadays? $20 maybe? I'm not sure what the price of silver is. $30, something on that order. So it's, the rule, and interesting, I don't think I have the comparison, but the rule in 18th century England was that stealing 40 shillings or more was a capital offense. And I do not know what the price of silver was in England in the 18th century. It would be sort of fun to see whether the minimum amount to make it a serious offense was larger in one society or the other. And we could, oh, wait a minute. No, do I have this? Yes, I've got an ounce of gold in 1800 was £3.16, so about twice, so about half an, if that's right, about half an ounce of gold, half an ounce of gold, if I've got this right, roughly is what made theft capital in 18th century England. And at least in the Middle Ages, gold is about 10 times as valuable as silver. So that means about 5 ounces of silver, which is about 5 times as much. So you have to steal more in England for it to be a capital offense, but then it's capital rather than losing your hand. All right. Anyway, other details. The good that you steal has got to be something which you have a title enforceable of law. So that, for example, if you steal something that's forbidden, if I steal wine from a Muslim, that doesn't count as a hot offense because he wasn't entitled to own wine. If I steal pork, that doesn't count as a hot offense. He wasn't entitled to own pork. If I steal a slave, doesn't count as that kind of property. If I steal a free child, in the opinion of most of the schools, kidnapping is a less serious offense than theft in that sense, because the child wasn't owned property, and therefore, and I put it as a less serious offense, but what's really going on is, it's not the offense which the Quran tells us we have to punish in this way, really. It's not as though the people who are interpreting the law are expressing an opinion about how serious things are. They're just saying, does it or doesn't it fit within these limits? The theft must be by stealth and not open, and that will come back to in Iceland, as if you get the same requirement. The goods must be one to which the thief has no colorable claim. So that at least some legal authorities hold that if you steal property of the Muslims, if you steal from the treasury, so to speak, that's not Baha'i offense because you were a co-owner. Fairly minor co-owner, but you were a co-owner. It must not be something you didn't have a reason to believe was yours, even if the reason was wrong. Furthermore, things that are in a wild state, if I steal unharvested fruit from your orchard, that doesn't count. And the stuff must be taken from a place of safekeeping. So that means that if you have a cow wandering around in the field, that probably doesn't count. And furthermore, what seems weird, if I'm an invited guest, now I'm not feeling it's not in safekeeping because you let me in. It reminded me a little bit on that one. I don't know, do any of you know much about trade secret law, modern trade secret law? But one of the requirements to claim something as a trade secret is that you made reasonable efforts to keep it secret. All right? Well, that looks rather similar, as though the evidence that it's really valuable information you care about is that you went to the trouble of not letting people see it. Yes?
Does that still, you mentioned the cow walking the field. Yeah.
Don't know. I think once it's in your barn, I think it's theft. But I don't know about the defense. And the answer is probably there isn't a single answer. There's one of the points, it's a digression from this era, but one of the important points about Islamic law and Jewish law is there isn't a Supreme Court. All right? So the part of what's interesting is that it feels to us, or it seems logically, as that you can't have a legal system unless there is some authority that gets to finally decide the rules, which isn't true empirically. Because here we've got legal systems that existed for hundreds of years, for large numbers of people, functioned, in which there was no mechanism that guaranteed that Judge A and Judge B would agree. Judge A and Judge B can disagree at first impression, but at least in theory, if it's important, you can always carry it up to the through the appeals courts and they have to agree. No such mechanism there. And as far as I can tell, it was considered perfectly legitimate for two judges of the same school if that school had more than one legitimate opinion on the question, which it sometimes did. You know, this scholar of our school says X, and that says Y, which sometimes happened. Well, the judge gets his choice of which one he wants to follow. Now, of course, there's a lot of discretion in practice in our system as well, but in theory, at least, ours is unified in the sense in which theirs is not. Stealing a shroud is not the hot offense. I was looking down this list of things, either on the grounds that the shroud no longer belongs to anybody, since the corpse it's in is no longer capable of owning property, or that it is not in a safe place because it's out there in the grave with nobody guarding it. Other things, keep going. What? Yeah, the point I was making was not their trade secret, but that there's a parallelism between our trade secret law, which says it's only a violation of trade secret rules if you were taking reasonable precautions to protect the secret, and their rule, which says it's only the hot offense of theft if you were taking precautions to keep the thing from being stolen. So that in each case, you're somehow demonstrating the status of the thing by your own behavior. At least that's the way I would make sense of it. Stealing a cross is not the hot offense because no good Muslim should possess a cross. It's a symbol of a false religion. And stealing a book, this is what I thought was interesting, that the value of what makes a book valuable are the words, but that doesn't count as property, unlike our IP system. They don't have a copyright system. So therefore, presumably, the only time that stealing a book meets the minimum value requirement is if the paper it's made out of was worth that amount. And there is, in fact, an American computer law case that parallels that, weirdly enough. One of the early computer crime cases in the University, it was Virginia Polytechnic Institute, in fact, is where it happened, where I was a professor at a different time. And you've got a graduate student who gets access to the computer that he's not off. What's going on, as far as I can tell, is that he was supposed to be provided access to the computer for his research. he somehow didn't get it or was too shy to ask or whatever, and ends up, I think, I'm not sure if he steals someone else's key to get, I don't know, this is the early days when the computers were using packs of cards and things. But in any case, it turns out he's been doing unauthorized access to the computer, and he is charged with theft of, I don't know, property worth $1,000. There's some limit for making, above which it's a serious crime, and he's charged with the serious crime on the grounds that the value of computer processing he's being used is more than that amount. And there is no computer crime law at this point, so it's going under existing state law of theft, and he's let off on the grounds that that the theft doesn't cover services, and the only property he stole was computer cards, and the computer cards were not worth nearly enough to cover that. And VPI gives him his PhD, so it's pretty clear that from their standpoint he had done nothing wrong, even though the local law enforcement thought he had. A problem, by the way, which I guess is hopefully decreasing now, is that when you have a new technology, judges are old men, typically, and therefore may really just not understand the technology. And I think at least my impression looking at the early computer crime cases is that that's part of what's going on. They just don't follow what's going on. But that's another issue. Anyway, proof for stealing is two witnesses of good character or two confessions by the thief. And the thief is not morally obliged to confess even if he's guilty, and he can retract his confession. But remember in all of this that all of these are the requirements for the Hod offense, not for theft in general, so that somebody who doesn't meet one of these requirements could still be charged under Tazir, under the discretionary punishment, and then the judge could decide what punishment he thought was suitable. Other questions? Yes.
It seems like, third time we talked about law systems that seem to have a really harsh punishment, but there's always requirements for the method of pardon. Do you find that a lot of systems have this kind of thing?
It's certainly true. That's an interesting question. 18th century English, it's true in the sense that only a fairly small minority of those who've committed capital offenses actually get hanged, although being transported for whatever it is, 17 years of indentured servitude is a pretty serious punishment too, obviously. In Chinese law, you have the whole pattern of people being condemned to execution after the assizes, which in practice usually means you don't get executed, although you do get a fairly serious punishment short of execution. We'll get to it later, but there's this elaborate procedure in which the emperor decides basically who is going to actually get punished from the list of people who are supposed to be punished. And in Jewish law, we've at least got the case of the disobedient son. I'm not sure it's true more generally than that. In Islamic law, we have this. Where else do we see it? I mean, you could say it's true of American law. I gather somebody has written a book claiming that the average American commits one felony a day. And I don't know if it's true or not, but I think it's probably true that our legal system is wide enough and unclear enough so that most Americans could be argued to have done something that was a felony at some point. There's this whole issue about if you violate the terms of service on a computer, on an online interaction, whether or not you're violating the federal law, which some people claim you're violating when you do that basic computer crime offense. But I think there are various other things of that sort which could be considered felonies. And although we have an awful lot of people in prison, you could argue that it's a lot fewer than would have if we really enforced the law. So I guess that would be. I'm trying to think whether there are other examples that I know about where you have, because there is sort of the idea, at least the what's claimed to be the view of the legalists in China, that you have ferocious punishments and then nobody commits crimes and you never have to punish them. That's not quite the same thing, but it's, I don't know. I don't know how common. You can certainly see the incentive for it, because you say, look, what we really want to do is to deter. Well, to deter, we don't have to actually punish you, we just have to think we're going to punish you. So that would give some, and you could also see the argument when it actually happens and saying, look, we haven't deterred, it happened, now do we really have to hang this guy now? We can find something less serious to do to him. And that's going to be always a tempting position at the same time that the hard-hearted judges say, no, no, if we don't hang people when they do this, nobody will believe us next time. And therefore, they will commit whatever the crime is. All right, let me go back to that thing about the cat drinking from the saucer, because I found that quite intriguing in terms of sort of a little bit of a snapshot of the scholarly arguments over how you decide whether hadith are genuine or not. I don't know how well people follow this, but one line of argument is that you look at the pattern of isnads. The isnad is the list of sources that the hadith came from. So one argument that some scholars make, and then someone else is disputing it, is suppose you've got the same hadith with 10 different pedigrees. All right, so this hadith says, on such and such an occasion, Muhammad said such and such. Well, how do we know that? It was observed by A. So here's Muhammad did or didn't say something, and that was supposed to be observed by A, and A told B, and B told C, and C told D, and so forth. Okay? And now the question is, what if there are a bunch of different chains for the same tradition? Well, that's not absurd. After all, more than one person could have heard Muhammad say it, or A could easily have told it to more than one person, and so forth. Well, the claim is, suppose it turns out that the pattern is A, B, C, D, and then it starts branching to E, F, G, H. And the claim that's being made by the revisionist is, this is really a very unlikely pattern, because after all, you would think that A, B, and C would all have told somebody else that, you know, this is important news. So therefore, the conjecture is that what's really going on is that D made up the story. And since D made up the story complete with its isnad, of course, everybody got it from D is told A, told B, told C, told me. And then after that, D tells it to several people and spreads out. So that's one of the arguments used. And the claim made is that if you look at lots of hadiths, you get this kind of a pattern. And therefore, the claim is they must have really been embedded several generations down with a spurious tradition. All right, so far? Now, the counter-argument is, look not only at the isnad, but also at the actual content of the hadith. Because you will have parallel hadiths where the wording is somewhat different, or the details of the story is somewhat different, but they're obviously the same story. And you ought to be able to parallel this by the question of when did the variance branch. That you would think that if this is the correct story, then everything from A, B, and C, this should all be the same, but by this time you might start getting different variants. All right? So if you then trace them out, and sometimes you know you have a variety of other sort of elaborate spider web of authorities, see whether when the text varies is consistent with the supposed pattern of transmission. If it is, that's evidence that really is the pattern of transmission, and then it's a counter against which claim. So that's part of what's going on. But there's lots of other stuff going on in that article. That was an interesting article, and part of it is when you say this is the book of Malik, who's the supposed founder of the Maliki school, that doesn't really mean that Malik wrote it down and people copied it. They weren't doing it that then. It means that Malik gave lectures. If he was taking notes on his own lectures, then he probably gave the same lecture again and again. We don't know that for sure. His students wrote down what he said. And so you will have several different versions of the Book of Malik by different students, which are going to be pretty similar. But if you imagine, you know, detailed notes that you people take in this class, they're not going to be identical. And then you have to explain the variance from that. And a further point, the argument starts with, which seems very compelling until you see the counter-argument, the counter-counter-argument, is the question of two different books of Maliki law, of which it was believed that one was earlier than the other. And the argument is that the one that purports, let me see if I've got this right, that the one that purports to be later has an elaborate justification for the claim that a cat does not pollute water. The one that claims to be earlier cites a hadith from the Prophet saying that a cat doesn't pollute water. Well, the argument is that if the order was really like that, the second book, the guy would have read the first book. Once you've got a hadith from the prophet saying it, why do you have to have all these elaborate arguments? Therefore, the order must have been reversed. It must be that the hadith was invented, that the first book is really the second book, and the hadith was invented by that. That's his claim. And then the counter-argument is, this assumes that when the second book was written, everybody agreed that hadiths from the prophet were the trump card in deciding legal issues. But if you accept the idea, which I think comes pretty clearly, at least in Shaft's analysis and some of the others, that that was a view that only gained ground over time, that initially people were defending laws on other grounds, and then as more and more people started claiming hadith to support their things, and people invented more and more hadith, so maybe if the book that gave the elaborate explanation, maybe he did know about that. He just didn't think it was very important, so he didn't bother to mention it, and he gave the answer. So anyways, I found it at least interesting. But let me end this, since we've got a few minutes, and I think I finished what I wanted to say, by telling you one of my very favorite pre-Islamic, actually, medieval Muslim stories. And this is the story of how the long war was ended between the brother tribes of Abs and Dubyan. Al-Harith was a great man of the tribe of the Dubyan, a lord of the Arabs. And on a day, he spoke to his cousin Qarija ibn Sina, and he said to him, "Tell me, cousin, is there any man of all the Arabs who would refuse me his daughter's hand in marriage if I asked it?" "There is one," he said, "Aus, son of Harith of the tribe of Tai." And so the two mounted their camel, and they rode a long road to the house of Aus of Tai. And arriving there, Aus opened the door, and he said to Al-Harith, "What brings you here?" And Al-Harith says, "I come according." "For the wrong door," said Aus, and closed it. And Al-Harith went away angry. But Aus went into his wife, a woman of the tribe of Abs. And she said to him, "Who is it who came and went away so quickly?" "Al-Harith of the tribe of Dubyan, a fool come according." "And you sent that Arab lord away angry? Would have thy daughters die knaves?" "What is done is done. It can be undone. Run after him and tell him that being approached suddenly, you were surprised, but now if he returns, you'll have all that he desires." And so Aus ran after Al-Harith and spoke to him the words his wife had given him, and Al-Harith came back. And Aus then called to him the oldest of his three daughters, and he said, "Here comes Al-Harith of the tribe of Dubyan, a lord of the Arabs in search of a wife. What thinkest thou?" And she answered, "I think ill of it. I am not fair of face or form. I am unpleasant of character, and he lives far from my father and need not fear him. And I fear that if he marries me, I will come to the fate of a divorced woman." And so Aus called before him his second daughter and got much the same answer. And then he called his youngest daughter, Buhaysa, and he said to her, "Here comes Al-Harith of the tribe of Dubyan, an Arab lord in search of a wife. What thinkest thou of it?" And she says, "As my father wills." And so he told her what her sisters had said. He said, "Well, that is for them. But as for me, I am fair of face and form, noble of spirit, and I have a most famous father. If my husband divorces me, God will never be good to him again." And so it was agreed that Buhaysa would wed with Al-Harith. And Aus had a tent pitched in the courtyard and sent the couple in. Now the rest of this tale we have from the cousin of Al-Harith, from Qarija ibn Sina, and he says, they went in and in a few minutes he came out again. And I said to him, "Is the matter accomplished?" And he said, "No, I reached out my hand to her," and he said, "What? In front of my father and my brothers? Impossible." And so we mounted our camels and we rode back towards our own country. And in a little while, Al-Harith and his bride turned off from the road and he said to me, "We will come up with you in a bit." And very soon he came up with me. I said, "Is it accomplished?" He said, "No." I reached out my hand to her and he said, "What? Would you take me like a slave girl bought in the market or a captive in war? Nothing. Until you have summoned your Arabs to the feast, slaughtered camel and sheep, and done all as ought to be done for one such as myself." "Well," I said, "she's a girl of spirit and good sense." So we came home, and Al-Harith called his Arabs to a wedding feast, and he slaughtered camels and sheep, and he went into his wife, and in a few minutes he came out again. And I said to him, "Is it accomplished?" He said, "No, I went into her hot with lust, and I said, 'See, I have summoned my Arabs to the feast, I have slaughtered camels and sheep.' And she said, 'Well, I had heard you were a man of some nobility and sense, but it seems you are not. What are you doing marrying women when the Arabs are killing each other?'" For this was in the time of the long war between the tribes of Abs and Dubyan. "Go thou out to those warring tribes and speak peace, and then thou shalt have all that thou desires. She is a wise woman, I said. And so I and Al-Harith went out to the tribes of Abs and Dubyan, and we preached peace to them. And it was agreed that the dead should be counted up on each side, and that tribe that had killed the larger number was to owe blood, white, and camels to the other. And it came to 3,000 camels among them, and it was paid out over 3 years. And when that was done, Al-Harith went into his wife, and she bore him many sons and daughters. So that, for the Greek scholars, is the Trojan women in a Bedouin version.